Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, to lie or not to lie, at a time when fewer and fewer Christians seem willing to put their lives on the line for their faith, we wonder whatever happened to principle, human dignity, and truth. We hear the story of one man who refused a lie even if it would have meant saving his head. And how Catholics can navigate our increasingly secularized world and keep the integrity of their faith. On a recent visit to the Mideast, I happened to meet a young couple from a small religious sect found in many Arab countries. While many Arabs would consider them Muslims, my new friends told me they weren't Muslim at all. But the misunderstanding was fine by them if they could get on with their lives as they were used to doing. They belong to a secretive sect which has for centuries remained an enigma to outsiders. Its creed and codes of conduct guardedly passed down from generation to generation only in the age of adulthood. When I asked the young man to elaborate a little on his religious beliefs, he winked and grinning, he said, "We lie about our faith all the time." "What do you mean?" I wondered, astounded by his frankness. "You Catholics and Christians over the years have been so ready and willing to become martyrs for your faith," he said. "We, on the other hand," he explained, "have been taught to lie about our faith in times of persecution. Why be killed for your religion if you can live by simply saying you belong to another faith while you cross your fingers behind your back?" "What would have happened to our religion," he reasoned, "if over the centuries we'd admitted we practiced it and we were then killed because we refused to convert?" I suppose one could argue he had a point. Choosing the lesser of two evils, telling a fib versus the possible extinction of an entire faith. Perhaps he was lying to me, even as he said this. But his comments made me think of all those early Christians martyred for their belief that Jesus Christ was Lord. Were they upholding an undeniable truth? Were they fools? Had they died in vain? From a handful, those first Christians now number billions. Well, at a time when it seems fewer and fewer Christians would be willing to put their lives on the line to defend their faith, I wonder what has happened to our defense of principle, human dignity, and the vindication of truth. Surely, these must be part of the equation. In the following program, Jill Bevilacqua tells us the story of one man, now a saint, who thoroughly believed in the principles of his faith. A man who refused a lie that would have saved, literally, his head. Does he stand as a model for Christian witness today? I'll let you decide.
It is sometimes said that those who become martyrs receive a warning from God beforehand.
Of Thomas More, beheaded on Tower Hill in London in 1535, a story is recounted in the journal of his daughter, Margaret Roper, which suggests that he too had a presentiment of his tragic destiny. He was lying on the hay, with his head on Margaret's lap. His eyes were shut.
Father, are you asleep?
Yes, and dreaming.
What are you dreaming of?
Of a far-off future day, Meg, when you and I will look back on this hour and this hayfield and my head in your lap.
Perhaps More thought he would become a martyr, but he certainly never sought martyrdom. He relinquished life most unwillingly, for he enjoyed it and asked no more than to be allowed to live in peace with his beloved family and many friends. This was not to be, and as Moore was a man of conscience, a man of integrity, and above all a man of prayer, he had no hesitation when forced to choose between God and man. He chose God.
Thomas Moore was born in Cheapside, London, in 1478. At the age of 12, he became a page in the household of Cardinal Morton, the King's Chancellor, who recognized the boy's qualities and predicted a great future for him, though he could hardly have guessed that Moore, too, would become Chancellor one day. After reading Greek at Oxford, Thomas was sent by his lawyer father to study law at Lincoln's Inn, and at 19, he was called to the bar.
Thomas became a brilliant lawyer, but he was also a scholar and the friend of scholars, and he entertained at his Chelsea home the greatest minds of Europe. He held advanced views on the education of women and inspired all his children, especially Meg, with his love of learning. A popular orator, a witty and merry person, his company was sought even by the king, Henry VIII, who made Moore his chancellor when Wolsey fell from power in 1529.
But Moore was an astute judge of men and had no illusions of where he stood with the king. He spoke of this to his son-in-law, William Roper.
I believe he doth as singularly favour me as any subject within his realm. Howbeit, son Roper, I may tell thee I have no cause to be proud thereof. For if my head could win him a castle in France, it should not fail to go.
Moore was not far from the truth, though it was not for a castle in France that he lost his head. In 1532, when Henry wanted to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn, Moore could not but oppose him. Moreover, Henry and his followers were passing bill after bill, abolishing papal rights and privileges, and confiscating church revenues. Moore resigned his chancellorship.
From that moment on, Thomas Moore was persecuted. He was essentially a public man, in words and actions, but in this, the greatest issue of his life, he was forced into silence and inactivity. Reduced to poverty, he hoped that by keeping silent, he would be left alone. But the confrontation came in 1534, when the Act of Succession was passed. In the preamble of the Act, the Pope's jurisdiction was repudiated. It was the point of no return, and Moore, together with Bishop John Fisher, refused to sign. He was committed to the Tower.
Moore had tried to prepare his family for his arrest by having someone knock on the door and call for him on several occasions. When the summons finally came, he allowed none but his son-in-law, Roper, to go with him. And to him he turned, saying, "Son Roper, I thank our Lord, the field is won." At the time, Roper did not understand Moore's meaning, that he had won his conflict with himself. No one, not even his family, could persuade him to change his mind. Friends of his who were members of the council did their best to shake his resolution in the hope of saving him. His wife and daughters were allowed to visit him for the same reason. Margaret, although she sympathized deeply with her father's position, did her utmost to get him to speak the formula which would set him free.
You want me to swear to the Act of Succession?
God more regards the thoughts of the heart than the words of the mouth. Or so you've always told me.
Yes.
Then say the words of the oath, and in your heart think otherwise.
What is an oath, then, but words we say to God?
That's very neat.
Do you mean it isn't true?
No, it's true.
Then it's a poor argument to call it neat, Meg. When a man takes an oath, Meg, he's holding his own self in his own hands, like water. And if he opens his fingers, then he needn't hope to find himself again. Some men aren't capable of this, but I'd be loath to think your father one of them.
So should I.
Then
there's something else I've been thinking.
Oh, Meg.
In any state that was half good, you would be raised up high, not here, for what you've done already.
All right.
It's not your fault the state's three quarters bad.
No.
Then if you elect to suffer for it, you elect yourself a hero.
That's very neat. But look now, if we lived in a state where virtue was profitable, common sense would make us good, and greed would make us saintly. And we'd live like animals or angels in the happy land that needs no heroes. But since, in fact, we see that avarice, anger, envy, pride, sloth, lust, and stupidity commonly profit far beyond humility, chastity, fortitude, justice, and thought, and have to choose to be human at all, why, then, perhaps we must stand fast a little, even at the risk of being heroes.
But in reason, haven't you done as much as God can reasonably want?
Well, finally, it isn't a matter of reason. Finally, it's a matter of love.
Moore did not believe himself worthy of martyrdom, nor was he at all sure that he would be equal to it should he be brought to the test.
Robert Bolt, who wrote A Man for All Seasons, from which this scene is taken, made this comment on Moore's stand.
He knew what area of himself he could yield to the encroachments of his enemies, and what to the encroachments of those he loved. But at length he was asked to retreat from that final area where he located his self. And there this supple, humorous, unassuming and sophisticated person set like metal, and could no more be budged than a cliff.
Thomas Moore did not condemn the many others who signed the act, nor encourage any to follow his example. All he would say of the oath was, "This I am sure, that of those that have sworn it, some of the best learned, before the oath was required, plainly affirmed the contrary of such things as they have now sworn."
To Margaret he confessed his fear of pain, telling her that he was almost afraid of a fillip, and that his flesh was by nature much more shrinking from pain and death than he thought it the part of a faithful Christian man. Knowing that he might be put to the rack, Moore took the precaution of writing to a friend that if it should be heard that he had taken the oath, people would realise that he had done so only in weakness, and not because he had changed his views. Over 400 years later, Cardinal Mincenti, in the same situation, did exactly the same thing.
Moore was in the Tower for 15 months, during which time he maintained his silence, despite constant efforts on the part of the King's men to extract a treasonable statement from him. It was Richard Rich, a former member of Moore's household and now Solicitor General, who finally provided the pretext for bringing Moore to trial. Rich, who was a notorious time server, falsely reported a conversation he had had with Moore in the Tower.
Rich asked Moore if he would take him as king, if Parliament so decreed, to which Moore replied yes, since that was good constitutional law. Then Rich asked, "But if there were an act of Parliament that the realm should take me for Pope, would you not then, Master Moore, take me for Pope?" To this, Moore offered a question of his own. "Suppose the Parliament should make a law that God should not be God, would you then, Master Rich, say that God were not God?"
And at this point, Rich reported Moore had added, "No more could the Parliament make the King supreme head of the Church." Moore never spoke these words, but Rich testified against him in the witness box, and on the perjurer's false testimony, Moore was convicted of high treason. Before sentence was passed, Moore was allowed to speak. He knew now that there was no redress, and broke his silence at last.
"To avoid this, I have taken every path my winding wits would find. Now that the court has determined to condemn me, God knoweth how, I will discharge my mind concerning my indictment and the king's title. The indictment is grounded in an act of Parliament which is directly repugnant to the law of God. The king in Parliament cannot bestow the supremacy of the Church because it is a spiritual supremacy. And more to this, the immunity of the Church is promised both in Magna Carta and the King's own coronation oath. I am the King's true subject, and pray for him and all the realm. I do none harm, I say none harm, I think none harm. And if this be not enough to keep a man alive, in good faith I long not to live. I have, since I came into prison, been several times in such a case that I thought to die within the hour, and I thank our Lord I was never sorry for it, but rather sorry when it passed. and therefore my poor body is at the king's pleasure. Would God my death might do him some good.
On July 5th, Moore wrote to Margaret, sending her the hair shirt he had worn for 40 years and telling her he was to die the following day. The king, fearing Moore's eloquence, had sent word that he was to speak no more than a few words from the scaffold. So Moore told the crowds that when he first accepted office, the king himself had given him the most virtuous lesson that ever prince taught his servant, willing him first to look unto God, and after God, to him. This, Moore claimed, he had done, concluding, "I die the king's good servant, but God's first."
Moore's last words were in perfect keeping with his whole life and character. He jested with the lieutenant of the Tower, charged the executioner to strike straight, and pulled aside the beard he had grown in prison, saying jokingly that it had committed no treason.
Thomas Moore was beheaded on July the 6th, 1535, a few days after Bishop Fisher. According to custom, his head was impaled on a pike on London Bridge. But Margaret bribed someone to give it to her, and she preserved it all her life. It is buried with her in the Roper Vault in St. Dunstan's Church in Canterbury. His body was first buried in the Tower Chapel, and was probably transferred later to the tomb he had prepared in the church at Chelsea. During the London Blitz in the Second World War, the church was destroyed, but one thing was left intact, the tomb of Sir Thomas Moore.
Thomas Moore was a man who enjoyed living. As his friend Erasmus wrote, "There is nothing that occurs in human life from which he does not seek to extract some pleasure, although the matter may seem serious in itself." But when Moore was put to the test, he found something in himself without which life was valueless. His own act of self-validation turned out to be a martyrdom that he did his best to avoid, but that he had to accept if he was to see any coherence between the course of his life and its end. His death was not the headlong rush of a fanatical zealot into oblivion. It was the fearful, considered decision of a man of great self-knowledge, doing what he had to do, and wishing, almost until the end, that he did not have to do it.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program drawn from her series Witness on what it is that makes a martyr. Sir Thomas Moore was beatified in 1886 and canonized by Pope Pius XI in 1935. Go into the supermarket, we can stop at the vegetable counter and pick out the choicest apples and lettuce. But as Catholics, can we do the same with our faith? Can we pick and choose the things that to us are most appealing? What about birth control, premarital sex, divorce? What about some of the sacraments like reconciliation? Well, I asked Father Bernie O'Connor, a former official at the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches, how to navigate our increasingly secularized world.
I think what's important is to look at some of the areas, again within our own society, in which commitment has the integrity and the courage to make demands of young people, and indeed of people in general. For example, I have some young cousins who are very much into martial arts. They get up at about 5 o'clock in the morning and they go to practices. They follow a diet which would make traditional spiritual fasting look quite moderate by comparison, they're willing to give all kinds of attention to their physique and to their mental attitude so that they will be able to go out and to break bricks with their right hand. And it amazes me that when people are motivated and see some purpose and some meaning in an activity or in a stance, they will pursue it aggressively and with everything within them. I think it's very sad that if the same people went to martial arts and say, oh, well, getting up early in the morning to go work out. No, I don't think I want that. I do like Saturday afternoon workouts, though, but I can't come in the mornings. Oh, diet. Well, I like some things that you're recommending, but not others. Oh, the medical visits to the physician. No, I can't do that all the time. If people approached what they most esteem with that kind of pick-and-choose attitude, they would fall flat in their face. And nobody would feel sorry for them because they were unwilling to give what was essential to reap the benefits of that relationship. But for some reason, popular consciousness, again fed by a very biased media, will say an opinion is sufficient to be spiritual. If I have opinions about God, it's the same as talking to God. It isn't. If I have opinions about the church, it's the same as being part of the church. It really isn't. And we will never get the worth of something if we fail or choose to simply give it minimalism as if that were our best. I remember as a child, but I'm not exactly old enough to be carbon dated, that when I would go to the local parish, it was normal to attend Mass on holy days of obligation. It was normal to attend Mass and to participate for the Sabbath, for Saturday evening or Sunday. Now that minimum has become the maximum. It was normal in my time. We went to the Sacrament of Reconciliation fairly regularly. Now people will say, well, I went 25 years ago. Or the last time I went was when I was in a car accident and I was in the hospital and the chaplain came to visit. I was scared I was going to die. Well, excuse me. Minimalism doesn't suffice in anything in life. Why do we imagine it is sufficient to be Catholic Christian today? Quite the opposite. Think of the martial arts example again.
You brought up the Sacrament of Reconciliation. Often, confession is seen as being outdated these days. Many people believe that they can simply ask forgiveness directly from God. Is confession outdated?
I don't think it's outdated at all. When you turn on the TV show and there's reality shows and talk shows in which people are very happy to tell you about every kind of sin, offense, and lack of virtue that has characterized their lives. I remember hearing on one particular show someone say about his infidelities and his adulteries and was very happy to tell 130 million American people where he had failed and proud of it. There's something again in our mindset that says if I broadcast openly, I feel good about myself to get it off my chest. And I think over the years in which I've been a confessor, in which people will experience the grace of that sacrament and then say, I feel so unburdened, I feel so relieved, I feel so good inside that the air has been cleared, as it were. Well, I would really wish that the same people who do have very positive experiences of this sacrament would not be afraid or hesitant to say it. Why is it we have to turn on reality TV and this and that to get a sense of people experiencing a new freedom, when in fact this sacrament ensures that there can be tremendous growth within the person? That can simply be talked about at our kitchen table or at home. And people say, you know, that really was a blessing to me. That was a gift for me. I felt so good after it. But instead, they'll talk about their fear of not participating. And there's a tragedy, and that's something we have to really examine. Again, our culture, our entire culture, will always condition people to say things like, why should I go and sit with a priest who's probably a worse sinner than me? I read that in the Boston Globe. It makes no sense to share with a priest who's a worse hypocrite than I am. And if we buy into that logic and rhetoric, well, the sacrament is going to fail, no question about it. But if we listen to those many, many people for whom the sacrament is renewing and invigorating and peace-giving, let their voice be heard, but let's be willing to listen to it.
I'm dealing with young children now who have had their first communion, have just done their first, their confirmation. And they say to me, Mom, I'm afraid to go to confession. I can't remember what I did wrong last time. And they're embarrassed to go to their priests. What is it about confession that sometimes makes young kids afraid?
Because they sense the fear in adults. When I was a little child, my mother would haul me off to the clinic to get a vaccination. I'd look at her face to see how she took the needle, and then I decided, I sure don't want that. Now, she'd say, oh, it's not going to hurt a bit, but I could tell by the expression she was afraid of it too. When young people sense that something good is not happening to us, when we use our words to say, oh, but it's so good, and it's so healthy, and it's so necessary, when they sense our anxiety and our concern and our inner negativity, we don't have to put it in words, they can sense it. And what words then do we use? And are we contradicting ourselves by our nonverbals in the same context? I think if young people could see in our faces and hear from our lips, I'm so grateful for the gift of that experience, then they'd want more of it, not less of it. I never hear young people complain because, oh my heavens, I have to go to another hockey game or calcio. Or, look, I want to go and spend Saturday afternoon this way, because everybody of their friends and their family say, this is where life begins and ends, my team, my love of the sport. And if people could say, the church, my team, and the sacraments, my reality, and I am bettered by this, and I'm so thankful for it, then that would make it irresistible instead of something to be resisted.
And a warm thanks there to Father Bernard O'Connor, a former official at the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.